Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast, Season 4, Episode 19. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hello, kids.
And we have Jaime Lopez Jr. on the line in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
Well, it's going.
All right. Nerdapalooza 2021 continues. It's awesome.
Now, which one?
Nerdapalooza 2021, man. We've got Star Trek. We got Hawkeye. We got all kinds of good stuff for you this week.
That's why people tune in. That's why. It's more than just podcast.
More than just Star Trek.
All righty. Yeah, so let's start off with some fact check. First of all, I wanted to apologize to all of our French-speaking listeners, because, I just totally butchered the... That was not even my grade 11 level French. In fact, I didn't really do very well in grade 11. I think it was the last year I studied French. But, yeah, so I realized I was, you know, winging it.
Yeah, like, we tried our best. It could have been, like, Flight of the Conchords.
Wait, what, we?
Oh, baguette, baguette, you know, Gérard Depardieu, you know.
Merveilleux.
Yeah, I think the phrase you're looking for, Tim, is je suis désolé.
J'ai au mal à la tête.
Where?
Où est la... Trans station, yes.
Oh, God, we're doing it again. We're doing it again. We're making it worse.
Parlez-vous le français?
Stop kicking that horse. It's already dead. Why are you kicking it?
All right, speaking of dead horses. So we were talking about The Man Trap was the first episode of Star Trek that was broadcast on September 8th, 1966. I couldn't remember the one. That's the one where... This ex-colleague of Jim Kirk gets jealous of him and has some sort of alien machine device thing that lets her switch bodies with him. So, you know, William Shatner does an amazing job at acting like a 60s era, you know, hysterical female.
Yes, acting.
Acting, yes, that's what you call that. And, and The Menagerie was first broadcast on that was the original shot as a cage for the pilot, but it was remixed and whatever into a two-parter called The Menagerie on November 17th, November 24th, 1966. That was, I think it was near the, near the end of the first season. Second piece here, Chella Horsdahl. Chella Horsdahl is best known by me, anyway, as Helen Smith in The Man from High Castle. I don't know if you guys had recognized her from things in the past, but yep. if you watch The Man from High Castle, she's a very central figure in that story. So have you guys, either of you watched that yet?
No, it's been on the long to-do list.
Okay, yeah. It's one of the first things when I started watching or tuning into my Amazon Prime account, that was one of the first shows to sort of tune into.
Yeah.
First two seasons are really good. The third one's kind of eh.
Yeah, she's got a pretty good resume of, when you add it all up, she was in that. She was in Stargate SG-1. She was in Arrow. She was in Aliens vs. Predator Requiem. She was in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. She's pretty decent sci-fi bona fides, and now she's got Star Trek. That's pretty impressive.
Yep.
Hey, she's Canadian. Did I mention she's Canadian?
You did. Canada's own. You mentioned
Canada's own. Born in Vancouver. Closer to Jaime than us, but still.
I guess, yeah. We were also talking about Wheel of Time last week, a series of books. It spans 14 volumes and one prequel. So that's 15, isn't it? Am I by math? And it began with The Eye of the World was the first one published. It was written in the 80s, but wasn't published until 1990. So... yeah, I got that from Wikipedia. You can look it up yourself, and I'll have a link in the show notes.
Wikipedia, notoriously reliable source for information.
By the way, I support Wikipedia, just so you know. Like, I pay them money every year when they come looking, and they're looking for money right now. So if you're a fan of Wikipedia, and by the way, you know, you can also edit Wikipedia. I have edited pages on Wikipedia myself, so it's basically a crowdsourced, you know, Encyclopedia Galactica, if you want to call it that.
Yep.
Anyway, I'm going to throw over to Jonathan for the headlines.
Headlines. So, last week, the three of us might have gone off a smidge on the fact that Discovery was pulled from international markets after the decision was made just before the eve of Star Trek Discovery's fourth season to take it away everywhere except for Canada and America and delay its release until 2022 because they want to roll out Paramount Plus internationally. As we were good indications of, there was a lot of upset people about this. And so we got news this week that the good folks at Paramount have decided to change their path on this. Sort of. So they issued a statement to all international Star Trek Discovery fans. We hear you. We're listening. We're going to do this for you. We're going to find a way to get this out. So they are making it available on Paramount Plus in the markets where it's available, which includes Australia, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile. I feel like I'm doing a bit from Pinky in the Brain. Colombia, Costa Rica, Denmark, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Finland, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Norway, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, Sweden, Uruguay, and Venezuela. You can now watch it if you have a subscription to Paramount Plus. And in the countries that it has been removed from Netflix, but is not available yet on Paramount Plus because it hasn't been launched there, like Austria, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Switzerland, so some small countries, United Kingdom, it is now available on Pluto TV. Raise your hand, gentlemen, if you did hear of Pluto TV before this article dropped.
Never heard of it before.
I have, which is why I was able to respond as quickly as I did to Tim's chat about that.
Wow.
Not like I've actively watched it other than like, oh, let's just throw something in the background. It wasn't a top tier streaming service. It never gets mentioned in the streaming wars until now, I suppose.
Well, they've just entered the fray with guns a-blazing, because apparently that is where you got to go if you want to watch Disco and you live in several of those major European countries. It's good news for those people. Obviously, it was, you know, we talked about the ridiculousness of trying to pull it away from those platforms in a digital world where things leak upon the internet and there are ways that they can be watched sort of in the gray market or the black, if you will. And yeah, so this is good news that they've done this. Does this make up for this move? What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, it did seem like a bit of a bonehead move in the first place, you know, because it just sort of, they just did it without it providing any sort of information about a plan to move it somewhere else, you know, like, I mean, if you were in those markets and you tuned in and you would be going, you know, what's going on here, you know, that wouldn't be the words you would use, but, you know, like, why can't I watch the show that's supposed to have been out and blah, 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 and I was able to watch it last year and where is it now kind of thing, you know? Great that they solved their problem, but do you really think they, or maybe they just didn't have the ink signed or something, but you know, it did seem a bit hollow that there was no announcement other than you can't get it on here anymore, you know?
Yeah. Last week. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting in a way. So for the price of a week and a day late for people who are in these countries who suddenly lost their ability, they get an interesting trade in that they get it effectively for free. I do believe Pluto TV does have ads, from what I recall. So it's kind of like, and I don't know that they have this on demand. I think you kind of have to watch it when it's on. So it brings this Star Trek series all the way back full circle into it's on the air, on the internet, but it's on the air again. And you better go, you know, remember that bat time and bat channel to get to it.
Right.
But it is free. I mean, I'm paying $5.99 a month for the pleasure of watching Discovery, and taking it a week later plus one day for free with ads. I pay for ads because I'm cheap and I only have the lowest tier of Paramount Plus. So I don't know. It doesn't sound like that bad a deal to me for those people in those countries.
But can you actually even get it in the United States? You can't, right? Pluto TV?
So I get Pluto TV. I seriously doubt they will show Discovery here because it would just kill a whole bunch of the subs that they want for Paramount Plus.
Yeah, right. That's true. Hmm.
Well, I still think obviously they clearly stepped in it and did not, I guess, anticipate how loud the backlash would be and have done their best to rectify it. So I think that's a positive. As we said, like there are alternatives to being able to watch it with a, you know, legal paid for means that I think a bunch of people might take advantage of, which is unfortunate. But when you release this kind of content that is so globally enjoyed, that's the risk, right?
Right. Yeah.
So now hopefully people will watch it that way and be able to enjoy it. And I guess they're going to have to pony up for Paramount Plus if they want to watch it for season 5.
Mm-hmm. All right. So last week, the Ghostbusters were making the original Ghostbusters. I mean, the surviving Ghostbusters, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Bill Murray were making the rounds on the various talk shows. And I happened to catch this one of them on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. I almost said Jimmy Kimmel. They were also on Jimmy Kimmel's show as well. So there's two videos out there on YouTube. But this one was interesting in that Dan Aykroyd talked about the source material for the Ghostbusters story, which was his great-grandfather's research into paranormal activities. So all this stuff like ectoplasm and all that kind of stuff came out of that, his grandfather's research. So and so we have Dan Aykroyd's great-grandfather to blame for all the reality TV shows where they, you know, examine the paranormal and all that kind of stuff. So, but, and of course, hilarious interviews, you know, between the three original Ghostbusters, especially Bill Murray on Dan Aykroyd. But yeah, so if you're in for a laugh, check that out. It's pretty good going.
Yeah, for me, I had my ears go up when he said Kingston, Ontario. I was like, oh, I know where Ontario is. Where is Kingston? And for those of you who are not familiar with Canadian geography, as I am not, I used Google to figure out that Kingston, Ontario is about halfway between Toronto and Montreal.
That's true. It is. Yep. And that's where the home of the Tragically Hip and Dan Aykroyd and Doug Gilmour, I believe, right?
I don't think he's from there, but he did play there.
Played there. Okay. Yeah, right. Well, because it isn't what Don Cherry used to always call him, Kingston's boy or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
I don't know. I've lost track. I've lost track of my Doug Gilmour histories.
That's true. Yeah. All right. Over to you, John, for some more Ghostbustery kind of stuff.
Yeah. So for speaking of Ghostbusters, we talked about, you know, would this be a go to the movie theater movie for us? I know I haven't seen it yet. I don't think either of you guys have made it out yet. Tommy, did you see Ghostbusters yet?
I have not.
Well, in spite of that blow to the economy, it still managed to rake in a 3-day total of $44 million US over its first weekend, which is pretty good given the global circumstances and everything else. So, yeah, overall considered a pretty successful pandemic box office, top of the box office in North America. So it is a success, and it'll be interesting to see if... you know, this is the start of a new franchise, a brick upon which you can build more things, or if this is a, you know, a nostalgia one-off.
Looking forward to it. I do want to go see it in the theater, though. So
yeah, I think
I'm going to find a time. All right.
It's really strange. I mean, it's good to hear that it's doing well, because the Rotten Tomatoes makes no sense. It is a hard split of 63%. For the critics and 95% for the audience.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely a fan favorite for sure.
Well, I read an online piece the other day where they were saying there's like 300, Jason Reitman put in 300 Easter eggs.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Was just heavily committed to, you know, making this the utmost experience for longtime Ghostbusters fans, which is really cool.
Cool. And also, just in time for this holiday here, the Lego folks have reissued a new version of the Ghostbusters car. I don't know what you call it. What's the name of the car?
I'm sure. Oh, the Ecto-1.
Ecto-1. Thank you. Yeah, it says right there on the front of me. I just can't read. So they've come out with this new, based on the Ghostbusters Afterlife Ecto-1 kit, which, you know, including the gunner seat and all that kind of stuff, and the little thing that pops out at the back to capture the ghosts. And I think it's actually reviewed. There's a video with the three young stars or four young stars.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. It looks pretty cool. So that's, and I'm not sure when it's coming out, because it does on the Lego site. When I looked at it the other day, it said not available, but I think it's coming out soon.
Neato. Next up, we've got some news. So we talked in an episode a couple of weeks ago about how there is a new Blade Runner animated series or anime series that is now on Adult Swim in conjunction with Crunchyroll. And stay tuned if you want to hear more about that, because I did watch the first episode of that. But we got some interesting news this week that Ridley Scott, the creator of this, as it were, the first director of the original film, is working on a live-action TV series. We already had got word that he was going to be working on an Alien series, and they announced that last year that he was going to be working on that. But a Blade Runner TV series, apparently, according to this article on Variety.com, is, they're looking at a 10-episode series. We already have the pilot written and the Bible, and we're presenting it as a 10-hour TV show. So, cool. Yeah, I mean, yes, please. Please, no Harrison Ford. Please, no Harrison Ford. Please, no Harrison Ford. Please, no Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I did watch part of the first episode, but I didn't get all the way through it, but yeah. Looks pretty cool.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that in the...
And it does pay homage to the original.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. We'll talk about that in the watch list. I'll give you a little taste of that one.
All right.
The next thing that I've got up here is that Scarlett Johansson, in spite of this unpleasantness that happened around her suing Disney over Black Widow, is apparently still in business with Disney. So... Mm-hmm. There was an event in Hollywood last week where the American Cinematique Award was presented to Scarlett Johansson, and it was presented as part of that was Kevin Feige, of course, the executive producer of all of the MCU movies and TV programs. And he was talking her up and talking about how great she is. And he said, "We're already working with Scarlett on another non-Black Widow related top secret Marvel Studio project with her as the producer." So for all those people that were thinking, well, she's burnt some bridges and we will never see her working with Disney or with the MCU again, I guess that's not right. I think they took a pragmatic approach of this, which is to say business is business. She, you know, felt like she needed to do what she needed to do, and they're mending fences and she's back to work.
Cool.
Would you put yourself in that same situation if somebody was like, "I am suing you because you breached what I think was an agreement or spirit of a contract"? Would you be like, "Yeah, come on back in, let's do some more work together"?
Well, I think it depends on the art and the artist, right? I mean, like in this case, you know, they're invested in her as a person, and I think it would be odd if they tried to, you know, move her out. But clearly the discussion she's having, or the issue she's having, is between the lawyers and the contract writers, not necessarily the producers or the film creators, right? So
yeah,
that's a different wing.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I mean, she's been a cornerstone to what Feige's done over the last 12 years, so
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. He's even has an impact in the in Hawkeye, which we'll talk about in a bit too.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty.
Next up, we've been talking about Dune a lot the last few episodes, given that there's this new Denis Villeneuve extravaganza in movie theaters and on HBO Max, or at least it was until this week when it left. The original vision of Dune, which was never actually made, was planned to be done by Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is going to do the this really wild vision in the 1970s. There's actually a documentary that's been made about the efforts of Jodorowsky to make this this film. And so this week we got news that the storyboards that were done for the film, the original storyboards that were done for that 1970s film, sold for $3 million at auction, and that's 100 times what they were expected to receive.
Wow.
The final valuation at Christie's auction house was between 25 and 35 million pounds, and it ended up selling for 2.66 million pounds, $3 million US. The drawings are collected in one large notebook and were made by Mobius, Jean Giraud, and also illustrated by Geiger, H.R. Geiger, the famous illustrator who created the Alien for Aliens. So, I mean, this is like original hand-drawn work by two of the all-time masters of the craft. So obviously there's a lot of value there. But given the infamy of this movie, not and the whole production not being made, yeah, very, very cool. Very cool, rare thing to have come to auction.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I mean, I'm a Mobius fan and also a Geiger fan because of my early, you know, dealings with Emerson, Lake, and Palmer and some of their albums, which are Brain Cell Surgery was illustrated by him as well. I wonder where my album is. I was thinking about that today.
I may have it here, actually.
Frame that up and put it up on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think I think I have your copy, but I found in a bundle that I bought a while back, I got a pristine copy of it, and it looks fantastic. It's again, I'm not a huge ELP fan, but that is a beautiful album.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean I had the original cover with the proper gatefold and all that kind of stuff, but I think it spent the time in somebody's garage for a while, so
yeah,
got a little damp. Anywho, And you're right. No, Jaime's up next.
Yeah, we've got the official trailer for DC's League of Super Pets animated film, which I don't know that I can describe any better than what is written here in the YouTube video description, which is Crypto the Superdog and Superman are inseparable best friends, sharing the same superpowers and fighting crime in Metropolis side by side. When Superman and the rest of the Justice League are kidnapped, Crypto must convince a ragtag shelter pack. Ace the Hound, PB the Potbelly Pig, Merton the Turtle, and Chip the Squirrel to master their own newfound powers and help him rescue the superheroes. Starring Dwayne Johnson as Crypto, you've got Kevin Hart as Ace, and then a whole slew of people that you'll recognize. Kate McKinnon, John Krasinski, Vanessa Bayer, Natasha Lyonne, Diego Luna, and Keanu Reeves. Coming out exclusively in theaters May 2022.
Yeah, and the trailer's pretty funny, too, like with Kevin Hart. It's a Kevin Hart, Dwayne Johnson vehicle as well, too. They have a good banter. They've done a few movies together, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the Jumanji ones are very funny.
Jumanji? Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they've done the last two Jumanji video game ones.
Cool. All right, and the last story we have here is I follow Jonathan Frakes' Twitter account, and he commented on this video of Sonika Martin Green on The View talking about, they were talking to her about, Whoopi says, hey, you were the first black female captain of a Star Trek ship. And, you know, kudos to her. And in the video, Sonika Martin Green credits Nichelle Nichols and Whoopi Goldberg for creating the path for her to follow on. So they in fact led the way for her to get to where she is today. So that kudos to her. But as a sort of sidebar fact check thing, I also noticed in some of the comments that were following the tweets was that Madge Sinclair, in fact, was the uncredited captain of the Saratoga in Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. And in fact, she's not just the first black female captain in a movie. She also played Sylvia LaForge, captain of the USS Hera in The Next Generation, season 7, episode 3. And she plays Geordi LaForge's mother. She also incidentally played Eddie Murphy's mother in Coming to America. And she was Belle in Roots, who was opposite John Amos, who famously played Kunta Kinte. LeVar Burton famously played Kunta Kinte as a young man. John Amos played him as an older man, and Belle was a central character in like the first, I think probably third or fourth episode of Roots. And she also played the voice of Simba's mom in The Lion King. So she's been around. I mean, you know, unfortunately, I didn't know who she was until I looked her up. I mean, I knew who she was from her face, but I didn't know her name and that kind of stuff. But she, in fact, should hold the record for being the first female captain, first female black captain of a Starship Enterprise or Starship vehicle ship. What do you call those things?
Vessel.
Wassel. Yeah. So then, kudos to her. And Nico Martin Green.
Thanks.
Yes. Which brings us to the main part of our show, which is why we're here to talk about. And I don't remember the name of the episode. So, Jaime, I think you're doing the recap. You're going to have to fill us in. So, but yeah, this is it. This is where we talk about a Star Trek vehicle. And this time we're talking about Discovery, Season 4, Episode 2. Take it away.
Anomaly is kind of an interesting episode. So we continue with Book having the severe trauma, definitely PTSD kind of thing going on from watching his family and his home planet of Quajon just obliterated. We end up with a little bit less of the sort of tension that we had with the Federation president in the first episode, and instead sort of put things over into, I think, some more, it's almost like set pieces in sports of like, they're kind of setting up what's coming in the future. Because at the end of this episode, if you follow sort of the A to B, you say, wait a minute, they kind of didn't really learn much of anything other than, wow, they're just really hosed, right? Like this anomaly is way worse than they thought. And they either can't predict where it's going, or maybe Discovery accidentally changed what it's doing, right? The whole point of this today's episode was a mission, a very dangerous mission, to go figure out, can we get data on this anomaly to predict where it's going, what it's doing, so they can evacuate planets and whatnot, right? Who are going to be impacted? And the sort of main thrust of the story is Book deciding that he's going to use his ship because it can get closer actually inside the anomaly than the Discovery itself can. And his ship having the transformer kind of abilities can go deeper in. And they want Stamets to be there as well, but since they actually say, wait a minute, it's probably a dumb idea to have like the two guys in the entire universe who can use the spore drive on the same dangerous mission, it's probably a bad idea. So they have Stamets there as a hologram with a neural transmitter kind of thing that he wears, you know, back on the Discovery. And so the real tension for Stamets' character working with Book isn't really so much about physical danger, because he's really not, I guess, other than the, you know, anti-gravity going off and him floating into space like everybody else does, in a kind of a really cool effect that they do. But rather more about some ego that was sort of hit in some ways around, like, you know, there's somebody else who can use a spore drive, not just this dude. And the, you know, you see, you know, what your loss was about and how helpless you were around things. So there's kind of like a tangling in of Stamets' previous loss of Dr. Culber, some previous, like, you got thrown into space, you know, some pushed out an airlock, as he jokes about with Michael. And so that, I thought that was kind of interesting to see these two characters who are like, hey, I don't think we really have said words to each other this entire time. I barely even know you. Why are you coming on this mission with me? Sort of thing that I thought was kind of fun. The other sort of major thing we had going on was Saru wearing the very stylish red command outfit coming back, and apparently a little taller, if not you know, in actuality, but more in the way he carries himself. He's an elder, as he has his little badge on his sash, and he's not what we saw in season one, right? He's not the cowardly prey kind of Kelpian creature, and he's not sort of lost about where he's at and things. He's quite happy being we're gonna call this what, the Star Trek VI rule of like, how many captains can you have on this bridge?
Yeah,
kind of
yeah.
Thing. He's like, he's technically, I think, still Captain Saru in
terms
of rank.
He still had his pips on. Yeah, he still had four pips. Yeah.
Still captain in rank, but he is the first officer for Michael, who is the captain of the Discovery.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it was very, very echoes of Star Trek V and VI, where Spock he's the first officer, but he's still Captain Spock. Because it's Kirk that gets demoted down from admiral to captain, but they're both captains, but Spock's the first officer.
Right. We've also got the other sort of storyline going on, of pairing off of characters with Tilly and Adira, with Tilly even realizing, like, I'm kind of Stamets-ing this person, of like, I'm getting kind of grumpy in my just double check your work. We always double and triple check our work, right? Like, just being curt. Granted, in a dangerous situation, right? They were trying to figure out, you know, can we predict when these waves are coming so we don't have the gravity fall apart on us? And Adira having a bit of the uncertain, it feels, on two different levels for them, where they are, you know, still trying to prove themselves of like, I can be part of this new Starfleet thing. It could be part of this, you know, this grand crew that saved the universe, such as it was last season. And also dealing with the weirdness with their partner, Gray, who apparently can get Picarded into a golem using 800-year-old technology, which the writer said, okay, let's just stop the people on the internet right now and say, oh yeah, it like didn't always work and not enough for people to bother. So they kind of just stopped doing the, can we make ourselves effectively immortal
thing. That's a great point, Jaime, because I, as soon as they were like, we've made this, it's based, I was like, that's based on Picard. Okay, so where are they going with this? I was ready. just like the rest of the internet, I was ready. And they were like, no.
But wait, they had 900 years to perfect this.
Well, 600 years anyways.
What, 600 years in the future are we now?
Yeah, because it's so that from when Picard happens to when this happens, Picard happens in the early 25th century, right? So, and this is the 31st century?
I think it's 32nd.
Is it 32nd? Yeah, so 600-700 years. It's still a definite huge leap in time, but yeah, I like that they were just like, no, we're stopping this right now. We tried it. It only worked occasionally. We stopped trying to try it.
They knew that everybody had already had their fists up in the air, ready to start shaking them violently. And then they threw a little Easter egg of like, oh yeah, I guess this guy Sung created it and he used it on some Starfleet admiral. Like, they just casually mentioned, you know, Picard without saying Picard, right? Which was...
Well, he did say Picard, didn't he?
Did they say
the name Picard? Okay.
He did, yeah. I think his name was Picard.
Yeah, and right after that, he talked about how they abolished seatbelts and
spaceships. Exactly.
Yeah, that one is, you know, I know it's for, you know, TV drama and stuff, but considering that we see that the programmable matter is able to create this really
cool... And they have magnetic boots. Don't get me started with that too, right?
I mean, okay, sure, right? They could just have magnet boots, like this is Face Off, and they're just walking around constantly. That's a good one. I hadn't considered that. But my take was like, well, you in the same episode, you have this physical tether using the programmable matter that they're going to pull Book's ship out if they can, if, you know, things go wrong. I'm like, maybe you don't want to wear seatbelts all the time. Like, I get it. They can be uncomfortable, but shouldn't you really have like an emergency seatbelt system using the programmable matter in case gravity goes out?
Or, you know, in the previous 800 centuries of space flying technology, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I noticed that when they sent up the giant Jeff Bezos penis rocket, they were wearing seatbelts.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, at what
that's
point true. In human evolution are we like, you know what? Seatbelts, don't need them.
I guess it was like an arrogance and hubris thing of like, I'm not going to go into space with a seatbelt like some sort of filthy animal. I'm going to walk around like as if I'm in, you know, my bedroom and getting me on my couch.
Wait, is that Deanna Troi sitting down in the command seat? Damn it! I wish we had seatbelts.
I'm pretty sure I've seen seatbelts in Star Trek before.
I swear in a previous episode that at some point they like lock themselves in somehow. I remember that being in part of a montage at some point.
Yeah, I guess the... So the main character thing, we've got this episode that leaves a sort of little hint for one of the things that they laid the groundwork for, if not this season, at least for, you know, the next several episodes, is Book's PTSD getting severe enough that he appears to see, physically see his, what was that kid? His nephew, right?
His nephew, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and he like gets distracted at critical times, thinking that he's seen them. He starts at one point when they're kind of hosed on the idea of like, I don't know if we can get out of this this anomaly. We're gonna have to try, you know, using the last bits of gas we have to surf the wave on the way out. I think he sees the dead birds, right? As if they were there again. You know, it's like he's reliving that trauma. Anything else
about that artificial wave thingy with the sailboat thing?
the Lieutenant Bryce talks about version or the idea of like surfing the wave, which
part? Surfing the wave, the part where Lieutenant Bryce says, and I quote, "I used to bullseye swamp rats on my T-16 back home. They're not much bigger than 2 meters."
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's
maybe he didn't say exactly like that, but it was very similar.
That's his hobby.
That's true. Sorry, Jaime.
I was getting shades of like, is he from Hawaii kind of things, like that Lower Decks episode.
Yeah, true, right, right. Or, but is he really from Hawaii? That's the question.
Exactly, exactly.
Bryce, shady.
Did I miss anything else major in this episode? Like, it's a very simple plot of we need to get from point A to point B. We need to scan the data. Oh, no, the data just told us we're hosed. And it's useful in that way, but not useful otherwise.
Well, the real dun-dun-dun is the end, right? Like, that's the dun-dun-dun. The whole thing is, you're right, it was a pretty standard Star Trek story. It's a story that's been told before. It was told well, mm-hmm. but it's kind of been told before. You know, people trying to come to grips with tragedy. Okay, that's been done. We have to get inside this anomaly and figure out, even though it's going to be dangerous. Okay, we've seen that before. But the dun-dun-dun at the end is when they start analyzing the data and they realize that, you know, they take a look at its patterns and realize that the anomaly, which they thought was based on a collision of two black holes, is actually being guided somehow. That it is deliberately targeting their ships. So the big dun 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 is, is this thing sentient? Is it being guided by some malicious force? Is there a you know, puppet master behind the curtain making this thing go? And then you do the big pan out where we sort of see this sort of menacing looking specter in the space, right?
Shape thing. Yeah.
So begin your speculation here.
Yeah, maybe Spock was really blasted, you know, into the future and as bitter and, you know, come embittered, and he's now like, that's never happened before, right?
No.
Speaking of Lost in Space, but yeah, no.
Yeah, it's good. Like, that was a good episode, but it was it was a little bit insert plot exposition here, right?
Yep. Yes, and they both almost break the fourth wall by looking at the they turn their heads towards the view screen, which is we're looking at them, right?
Yeah.
From that perspective, and they kind of like stare at us going, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Yep. I think, and, you know, the stuff with Gray is interesting. Obviously, the whole, you know, the body making a body. They keep talking about, you know, when you, take over this new body. They haven't said how. So that felt like a bit of a, like, I'm sure we're going to get that in the next few episodes, but they were talking about it very matter of factly, like, oh, well, we're just going to put your soul into this consciousness, even though Adir is the only person who can see Gray's non-corporeal self.
Yeah. So how do we know that Gray is not actually just in their body, their brain, you know?
Well, because we did see that when they were on the dilithium planet last season, right? Because Culber could see Gray there.
Right.
So we know that Gray, for lack of a better term, exists. But I just thought it was kind of strange. Like, they made, I think, two references to, you know, when you, you know, transcend or whatever into this body, or recorporealize or something like that. And I was like, you say it so matter of factly, like this is something you do on a Tuesday, you know?
Yeah.
I did like the intentional, unintentional joke of, you know, oh, throw me out an airlock. Stamets makes a crack at one point about, you know, oh, throw me out an airlock, which is exactly what Burnham did to him last season. That was pretty funny. And you're right. The effect where the gravity kept going on and off was really well done. Like, that must have taken some pretty cool, you know, wire work and stuff to make, you know, all the cast do that.
Well, it looked a little bit like, it looked a little bit of mix of 3D rendering and like, it looked like Michael, when she was doing her line, was actually, you know, sitting down separate, with her feet in the air. But the other characters, like Owo and
Detmer. They look like they were, for a second there, they look like little CG animations of the actors, right?
Yeah, and they did do a real pan out, so you're not really seeing them up. You just sort of see the what appears to be them. So it could have all been done CG, but it was well done. It was a cool effect. Again, I was trying
after
to think
the
of,
first time, wouldn't you say, hey, can we break out the Starfleet belts, please?
Yeah. I think it would have been probably the last time we saw a starship lose its gravity like that would have been Star Trek VI, right? Where the gravity goes out and then that's when Chancellor Vorkon gets killed, right? Like, we don't really see it a lot, which is strange considering these are spacefaring vessels, but...
True.
Yeah.
Well, and then the whole sort of thing, like, you know, how they replicate gravity in current, like, sort of relatively newish or within our timeline sort of things, you know, by having a ship rotate and that kind of stuff, you know, using centrifugal force. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which one Mark said was not real, but...
Between centripetal and centrifugal...
Centripetal, I think, is the real one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and that's where, like, you know, the ride that you go on at the amusement parks where you're pushed up against the wall kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
By getting spun around. It's always sort of been... I mean, you know, you have to sort of... You know, in the 60s, in 66, when Star Trek first came out, they kind of they never really sort of covered the sort of gravity thing because people didn't know about space travel back then, right? It wasn't until, you know, they started broadcasting the Apollo ships that they could actually see that they were actually weightless and stuff like that, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's always been a sort of, you know, for me, it's like even in Foundation, they had to put on the electric, you know, just the magnetic boots and walk on the outside of a ship. And which one was it? I think First Contact where they walk and they have to separate the big dish on the front.
Yep.
Yeah. And they have the fight with the Borgs, who also have magnetic boots, right?
Which are really just like part of their uniforms.
Yeah, their standard issue Borg footwear.
They get them when they're baby Borgs. They just put the magnet boots on them.
True, true. After they finish Borg crawling, that is. All right, well, let's move on to the Hawkeye, which I think we all watched. I watched the first two episodes yesterday, and I guess you guys must have as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very good. I mean, I thought it was really enjoyable. Like, it's enough that, you know, the first episode has enough going on. It's not too long. It's like 45 minutes long, right? So it seemed short compared to, mind you, I just finished watching The Beatles for like an hour and a half. But so it seemed kind of short. And then it ended with, you know, what now at the very end, you know? Mm-hmm. And that so it immediately picks up. And it's a good thing that they did publish the first two episodes because then you were able to just roll into the next episode. And then the second episode also ends with a what now at the end too, right? So hopefully they're going to be able to keep up that pace. But yeah, a really compelling story I found and interesting. I'm interested in the characters. I'm interested in the story. And, you know, they don't drive the Christmas theme too far down your throats, right?
No, and it's a good plot device given that the way that they've timed it out, they dropped the first two episodes on the 24th of November. Right. Subsequent episodes will be December 1st, December 8th, December 15th, and the final episode will air on December 22nd. So it times right out with, you know, and Clint's whole sort of reason for trying to get through this is I want to get home for Christmas, right?
Right.
So... as it builds towards, you know, our real-time Christmas, I think this will be one of those fun first watches just because they have timed it out so beautifully and themed it around the holidays and, you know, wintertime in New York. And, yeah, it works really well, I think. Yeah, it was interesting, I thought, the first couple of episodes. They definitely did a good job of establishing Kate Bishop as a very endearing character. You sort of
Is she Jessica Jones's niece? Wasn't that Jessica Jones's apartment she goes to?
That's what Xavier said. It looks a lot like Jessica Jones's.
When she was looking at the names, it said Gunter Jones when she was looking for to push the buzzer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it said Jones. I noticed that, and then when she got inside, it looked like Jessica Jones' hallway, and it looked like. Are we in the right universe?
Yeah, so maybe, but yeah, I mean, because that is set in the MCU, right? They just haven't brought it into canon yet, so.
Right.
Yeah, I think that might have been a sort of teaser. There was a few actually. There was a ton of Marvel Comics Easter eggs through the first couple episodes. It is drawing a lot of inspiration from the Matt Fraction, David Aja comic book series from 2012, which is, you know, the dog, Kate, Clint, the Tracksuit Mafia. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's come straight out of those pages. And it's a fantastic read. I highly recommend if anybody's looking to sort of get into the Hawkeye character world from this. It's a great read. But I mean, for longtime Marvel fans, a lot of this stuff is being telegraphed pretty fast and pretty hard. Like, they've introduced characters who... again, I won't get into too much spoiler territory, but like characters who are established Marvel characters with backstories that are unmistakable. So as soon as they introduce your character, you're like, oh, okay, I know where this is going. Like, it's just, it's, and it's not like, it's not deep cut stuff. It's pretty superficial stuff. So yeah, again, don't want to spoil too much. I know you guys obviously are a little less so on the comic-y side, a little more on the movies, TV show side. So, you know, in 4 weeks, we'll have a more fulsome conversation about all this stuff. But
I really enjoyed the way they sort of play on the, you know, aren't you Hawkeye kind of thing all the way through. Like when he runs into people, like, can I get a selfie with you? And like, he's at the urinal. He's like, not a good time, you know. But well, I like the way they sort of play with his infamy and his fame without, you know, and he's kind of like a reluctant superhero, right?
Well, and it's funny too, because he, of the many characters, obviously their identities were public in a way that they aren't or haven't always been in comic books. In comic books, it was the masked person. Who's that masked person? You know, most characters wore masks in some variety or the other. You know, Jeremy Renner in all these movies never wore a mask, right? He's not the stereotypical comic book Hawkeye who has, you know, the blue sort of cowl over his face that sort of hides his identity. So, yeah, of course, you know, he goes to the Chinese food restaurant and they're like, you helped save the city, have a free meal. He goes to, you know, different things and people are like, oh, I love you. Here, have, you know, do this and whatever. You know, even when he goes to the live action role play thing in Central Park, he ends up, you know, we all know who you are. You know, like, it's no secret, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But they don't know that they don't know, or do we know that he's Ronin? I guess we're not supposed
to
know at this point.
Nobody but his, I think, his wife and the Avengers. And even in the Avengers, I don't know if it's all the Avengers or it was just
Black Widow.
Black Widow that knew that he was Ronin. So.
Mm-hmm. And they did show the scene where he's dispatching people when they were talking about the sword, right?
Yeah, they cut that scene straight out of Endgame, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was good. It was a good balance of humor with action.
It's a bit like Kick-Ass too, in a sense,
and a good mystery in there too. There's a little sort of, you know, mystery element to it. I mean, I was really looking forward to that. Like I said before, Hawkeye's one of my favorite characters. Not as much the movie adaptation of the character, but I think this has been solid so far. I'm in already.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm in.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good too. The way they played him as being kind of done with the whole superhero business, but like not in the tropey grump sort of way. Like, he didn't hit those, like, you know, those normal points. It was more like, dude, I just want to go visit my family for Christmas. Like, I don't want to be dealing with any of this. You know, even when he is ready to beat the heck out of the Ronin person, he's like, you're just a kid. Like, you're just a damn kid. Like, I was here ready to beat the heck out of you, tear this thing off you and go home. And now I got to deal with making you safe after they firebomb your apartment and stuff. The tracksuit mafia, the Russian tracksuit mafia.
I just took a look online and there is a Reddit thread where they say, a lot of people are saying, Jessica Jones's apartment exists in the MCU. This is clearly the same building. The same observation as you, Jaime, the Jones Gunther thing. So, yeah, I mean, could be.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, it's the actress Vera Farmiga, who plays the mother, I always get her confused with the Olsons, right? But it's... what have we seen her in before? That
is she not from The Conjuring? Because that's who I thought she was.
She is, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Most famous, her most famous roles are probably, she's the recurring character in the Conjuring movies. She's also, she was in Up in the Air, which is a really good George Clooney movie. Yes, I did say that.
Oh, right. That one. Yes. Yeah.
She was in The Departed. Really good. The Scorsese movie, which is great. And I think, wasn't she in, she did another comic book. She did A History of Violence, didn't she? Isn't that Vera Farmiga?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm just scrolling through her IMDb right now. Oh, she's in Manchurian Candidate as well. But that's the, who's the director for History of Violence?
Oh.
Canada's Own.
Yeah, I want to say Cronenberg, but didn't Cronenberg did the other one, didn't he? My brain. My precious brain.
I'm on her page right now. I'm just scrolling through her movies. I don't see that one, though.
Yeah, I get her mixed up sometimes with... Oh, it's Maria Bello. That's who I'm thinking of. Maria Bello is the star in that one, so it's not...
And who was the director in that one?
That is Cronenberg.
History of Violence. That is Cronenberg. Okay, yeah. You were right.
Right? That's adapted from a comic as well. But I got Maria Bello mixed up with her for that role.
Cool.
But I love that movie. So good.
And of course, you all know famously that I stood in front of David Cronenberg at a parking meter once, right? You know that, right?
Yeah, I met him at the Star once. He was very nice.
Yeah.
He was in there with, what's his name? The guy from Due South. What was his name?
Paul
something.
Yeah, him.
Gross. Paul Gross.
Paul Gross. Paul Gross.
Yes. Paul Gross. Yes.
Cool. Alrighty. So let's move on to our watch list.
Yeah.
Shall we? All right. What do you got, honey?
I've got the still ongoing Wheel of Time first season of episodes on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So this is their live action one. I've been enjoying it so far. We've seen 4 out of the, I believe, planned 8 episodes for this season.
Are they all on now? Like you have to...
No, they... What did they do? I think they dropped the first 3 last Friday, and then they had one today. On Friday, so we're up to 4. So they did kind of I think the boys on Amazon did a similar kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah.
Oh, she was just the mother in King of Monsters. That's where I saw her.
Oh, the Godzilla movie. Yeah.
Yeah, Vera Farmiga with Millie Bobby Brown as her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I knew her from. Yeah. Sorry, Jaime.
No worries. I think it's worth watching if you liked Shadow and Bone on Netflix, which we've talked about before as a watch item. It is. It's slightly less young adulty than Shadow and Bone, which I think leans a little bit more teen and tween area. But it's not quite as solidly adult like Game of Thrones. Even though the first episode does throw some nudity there, so be aware there is some pretty heavy violence too. So it's definitely not kid friendly, and it's not quite as epically biblical like Lord of the Rings. So if you go into it with that kind of mindset of like, it's closer to Shadow and Bone, probably the Sword of Shannara kind of series, I think you'll have a good idea. I am curious, given that there are only 8 episodes in this season, and as you said at the top of the show, there are 14 volumes plus 1 prequel. I have no idea if this is going to be a 14 season series, if it is, they're going to condense some of it. I've never read the book, so I have no idea how far along we are so far in the first 4 episodes. And either way, it seems like an interesting plot, kind of a fun little way to spend your time.
What was your take on? I watched the first episode, but I haven't gone past that yet. What was your take on sort of the characters? Did you find yourself investing in them? I found it a little bit. Sort of, I felt like a little bit detached. I didn't feel invested in the characters after 1 episode.
I think that's fair because it doesn't feel like it's character driven. It feels like it's more plot driven, right? Like the characters kind of exist solely for the plot versus like, I'm really ingrained in what this person's personality is. It's more like their like archetypes.
Yeah.
That I'm taking out of it. So that is true. It is definitely more about the plot of the Wheel of Time, which, you know, sort of rebirths your soul every once in a while, and the Dragon Reborn, which is a person who gets reborn every once in a while, I think once a generation or something, and they can either save the world or destroy the world. And the, what do they call him? The Dark One, I think. They sort of generically named Sauron.
Because they Sauron,
a big bad person of like, I want to kill everyone. Kind of like they try to to use the Dragon Reborn to do bad things that you'd expect. And there's a Jedi, women Jedi, yep, or sorcerers, if you want to call them, the Aes Sedai, who try to prevent that from happening, right? So it's more about that than it is about the characters that I'm finding.
Yeah.
The characters seem pretty shallow so far.
And it's weird, because it would be like, as if the Jedi were searching for the Chosen One, but they weren't sure if the Chosen One was going to be good or bad, or be, you know, Anakin the Great Warrior or Darth Vader, and decided to start killing them all.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. It's a little like you're really not sure. Again, as I say, I've only watched the first one, so Jaime will have a better perspective. But I found myself thinking, like, are they the good guys? Are they the bad guys? Like, who am I rooting for here?
Yeah, I think without it being too spoilery, I think the way I understand what's going on here is you have so the Dragon Reborn, again, they're able to use the magic power in such a way that they're way more powerful than everybody else, which means they can thrust the world into peace, or they can thrust it into darkness. And the Dark One, surprise, surprise, he wants it to be in darkness, right? So that's a pretty easy incentive. The Aes Sedai, the priestess warrior Jedi ladies who use magic, they seem to have taken the approach of, okay, it's a 50-50 shot every time this happens, right? Right. So we could either all be in utopia, or maybe we're all in darkness for another generation. Like, let's avoid darkness, because whatever your problems are with our current politics, like, we definitely don't want to go back to the Dark Ages. So they have decided not to play to win, but to play not to lose. Seems to be their incentive. So it is kind of more gray, and like, they're not really good people, but you can understand the reason that they do what they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I should not leave off here without mentioning that in somewhere in the Wheel of Time cycle, the Dark One corrupted the magic so that it used to be that men and women could use it without any issues. It was corrupted in such a way, I think, using the Dragon Reborn at some point, such that men could no longer use it without going crazy. Yeah. So all of the Aes Sedai magic users and et cetera are all women, and they get very suspicious when a man shows the ability to use the power, because they expect him to go crazy. And over the past four episodes, we have seen some crazy people. So
we get a taste of that in the first episode. Like, right off the hop, we see somebody who is having visions and stuff like that. So we get that's clearly on the table. But then, as you say, they're sort of in that gray area where they're like, well, if there's a chance they're going to go crazy, we may as well just kill them anyways.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Sounds plausible. Sounds safe.
Yes.
You missed the mayor of Kingstown?
I wanted to try rolling it into something else. I kind of winged it on that one. But yeah, so I've gotten two, maybe three episodes into Mayor of Kingstown. This is on Paramount Plus, so I don't know what that means for you all. I don't know where this shows. This turned, for context, it is Thanksgiving or Yanksgiving here in America. And so this holiday weekend has turned into the Jeremy Renner show, as I watched two episodes of Hawkeye and three episodes of Mayor of Kingstown, which also stars Jeremy Renner, as he and his brother they're not really truly criminals. They're fix it guys, right? So they're gray, sleazy guys who help the gangs in this prison system sort of continue to operate, but like also try to keep the Crips and the Bloods from like killing everybody and mutilating each other, right? So they try to keep the peace by brokering drugs and other bad things. They're kind of more of like the Walter White kind of area of like, I do this for money. I don't really do it because I truly believe in crime. I don't truly believe in like any of this stuff. I just want to live my life and enjoy having something that's sort of like a job. It's pretty dark. So definitely not kid friendly. They do throw the nudity and violence right there in the first episode. So bear that in mind. It's pretty interesting to see Jeremy Renner play this kind of character, especially immediately contrast it with his very heroic Hawkeye character.
Yeah, I just looked it up, and it says Paramount Plus is the only place it's available, and you can subscribe to Paramount Plus here in Canada, so I suppose that is your option.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably not a must see, even though I have enjoyed it so far. You probably should wait until you're inevitably forced to use Paramount Plus for something like Disco or something, and then just go ahead and catch up on binging it.
So I stumbled across, I was watching Disney Channel today, and actually my Apple TV, actually, I guess, it has the sort of What's Up Next feature on the home screen. And when I just finished watching episode one of the Beatle Extravaganza, Get Back, I saw that there was a new episode of The Solar Opposites. I'm like, I wasn't expecting a new season of The Solar Opposites. So imagine my surprise when it turned out to be the Solar Opposites holiday special.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine any and all of the Christmas movie tropes that you could use in a... Imagine, you know, the Solar Opposites is the same folks that bring us Rick and Morty. So they're, you know...
And Lower Decks.
So lots of F-bombs, lots of irrelevance. It's basically a family of aliens living on Earth. And they have it's a couple of aliens. They don't really have sexes, although there's a female. That one of the children is leans towards female. And there's a pupa. And the pupa sort of... Huh?
She has a bow like Lisa Simpson. That's about as close as it gets.
Yeah, so, and very female type voice and sensibilities and things. But so they're just totally in love with the whole Christmas season thing. They're all in, they're drinking hot chocolate that comes out of a little Santa's butt, you know? And, you know, they're all into giving presents and all that kind of stuff. And they decide that, you know, they're going to have a big fun festival thing. Of course, the pupa is totally not into the Christmas thing. He's being a real jerk. So they send him away. He goes off and has a sort of second story, which comes around in the end. But they decide that, you know, as among all the fun that they're going to have, they're going to watch a holiday, you know, video, and they choose Jingle All the Way as the one they're going to watch. And of course, they get into it and they realize the only character that they can play in the thing is they have to play the father. So all four of them are Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? And they find out, they realize it's a pretty lame movie, and it's not very Christmassy sort of thing, and it's got, you know, very sort of commercial because you got to get this character. So they decide to bail on the movie. And then, of course, you know, then their whole Christmas spirit goes down to like zero, and they have a way of measuring their Christmas spirit. They scan their bodies, and so they have to go back and redeem themselves. So they drop all these things. So they try all these different movies. Like there's one point where they're in the, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. And so they go back to they have to go and finish the movie, The Jingle All the Way, and they go back into the movie. And I'm not giving tons away. I'm just giving the major plot point away. They go back in, and when they arrive, it's 80 years in the future, of course, you know, and of course, a typical trope, the kid never got the present. So now he's taken over the world. He's made himself like the mayor, chief, whatever of the whole society. The Sinbad character, the postal delivery Sinbad character, turns into like a zombies. So there's a whole, you know, zombie postal characters there. And it's very sort of like, you know, Walking Dead, survive it at all costs kind of thing, that people have come to become. And so they're trying to redeem themselves by finding this character for the son. But the son is now, and then so the picture of, they show the picture of the son on the cover of like a Time magazine. And he looks a lot like a former president of the United States. And you know, there's one point where the people that are helping them they realize they're actually imprisoned by them, and they're going to eat them now because they basically have got these aliens that are going to cook them up and eat them, right? Because they're with the zombies and the whole world becomes dystopia. You know, they don't have any food, so they're going to eat the zombies. But of course, the daughter had kept Jimmy Stewart's gun from It's a Wonderful Life. And so she shoots, she ends up saving the day, and then the older, the parent takes the gun away from her, and he says, you'll put your eye out.
Yeah.
So all the, like, any sort of Christmassy sort of, like, thing you can imagine in this thing, it's like 100 Easter eggs of just Christmas humor gone completely wrong, like, you know. Yeah, so I definitely highly recommend this. It's a great show. I love the show as it is, but I mean, this Christmas version, it's like they've gone over the top with Christmas on this particular episode. So I highly recommend. So if you watch, if you don't watch any solar opposites, watch this one, right? For sure.
Nice. Anyway. As an aside here, I did sign up for one of those Black Friday deals for Hulu, 12 months for.
Oh, it's on Hulu. Yeah.
$1. Right. And this is a Solar Opposites is one of those shows I'd kind of forgotten about because I have notably not had Hulu. But since this is, you know, $1 a month, I'm like, oh, this is a cheaper way to see The Orville in March when that starts than it would be if I just signed up for the regular price of Hulu. And this is one of the things I just went ahead and added it to the backlog of things on the My Stuff, I think they call it, on Hulu. So.
Yeah, there's two seasons to watch plus this Christmas special. So nice. I mean, you're not gonna lose anything if you just watch the Christmas special first.
Yeah, the boys and I have been watching, like, chipping away at it. I think we have 3 or 4 episodes. I'm watching it at different times with different sons. So Foster and I think have 3 episodes left to go in season 2, and I think Xavier still has all of season 2 and maybe 2 episodes or 3 episodes of season 1 still to finish. So I am in that typical familial dynamic of waiting around for other people so you can watch the thing you want to watch.
Yes.
And we got distracted too because Big Mouth came out, and Xavier and I both love Big Mouth. We watched Big Mouth together. So yeah, Solar's has just been sort of sitting there for a while. It would take us all of an hour to finish it, but yeah, it's just sort of sitting there.
That's a great show. I love it.
It's super funny. It is. And especially for our audience, if you like Lower Decks and you like Rick and Morty, it's right there.
All right. So over to you, John.
Yeah, a few things. So I did watch the first episode of Blade Runner Black Lotus. It's good. The world feels kind of true to the vision of the films, but the animation style feels like a 1996 video game. It's a little bit, it's funny because the backgrounds look so vivid, and there are times when, like, the animation looks really good and then it'll sort of seem a little stiff when they're moving. It's not CGI. It's not quite anime. It's kind of a little of both. And I guess just because both of the previous iterations of Blade Runner, Blade Runner 2049 are very dark and very adult, I think that's what I was expecting. And I guess it is, but it did have sort of it seemed like it was catered towards a younger audience. So I am going to stick with it. I'm going to watch the next few episodes and sort of see what I think, because I love that world and you know, I'm interested, but it was a little disappointing from a visual standpoint, I'll say, to start. But I will report back because, Blade Runner is such a cool property. And I think it's fun that they decided to go down this path with it, but I can't say that I love the look of it quite yet. Next up, Lost in Space season 3 is coming on December 1st, which is next week for us. And thanks to Tim, I'm way in on this series. I really enjoyed the first 2 seasons. I came to it a little bit late. Tim had watched it and recommended it. And if you've been listening to all 100+ episodes of Spotcast, you'll have heard Tim talk about it. And I'm really keen to see how they wrap this up. This is the 3rd and final season, which I think seems like enough, you know, like there's only so much you can do with we're stranded somewhere. We have to figure out a way off this kind of thing. I feel like 3 seasons is going to be a nice way to wrap this up. I don't think they needed to beat this into the ground and do 6 seasons in a movie. I think this is going to be a good way to sort of end strong. So I'm definitely keen to see how they land it and whether or not they stick the landing on this one.
Yeah, it's an interesting TV show. I mean, it's very much in the sort of style of the late 60s, early 70s TV shows in that. I mean, it even started in black and white the first season, right? But it kind of could have been like Gilligan's Island in a sense, you know, like, because it was around the same time, right? And But I mean, they did freshen it up by moving to like being able to get the ship fixed and move from one move to different planets. So there's some episodes when they're out in space and they run into, you know, derelict space stations and stuff like that. And they run into a lot of there's a lot of aliens like robots and things like that that land on the planet and where they're inhabited. So there's it they did freshen it up when it was a TV show, but I mean it is very like the Dr. Smith character in this iteration, the character is great. I love the person who plays the role.
Parker Posey, yeah. Parker Posey's the best, yeah.
Yeah, they've taken it's not, I mean, like I said before about the TV show, it started out being about the family Robbins and this robot, right? Mm. And Dr. Smith, who's like he was a saboteur who ended up being cast away on the ship with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of sort of what they do with Parker Posey in this one, but it very quickly became the people and the writers were more interested in the boy, the robot, and Dr. Smith, mm-hmm. right? And the other people became, you know, supporting characters. And you know, if you know, young Sheldon is an example where you know you're there to watch the kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the parents have plots, but they're not quite, you know, they're like B plots, right? And I think that they didn't even have B plots, like, you know, so they had some really top name actors playing the parents, and they ended up not being anything, right? I'm getting fat paychecks, I guess, for the time, right? But yeah. And then so the movie that they made in, you know, the late 90s was kind of weird, and they had that sort of thing with the, you know, the bitter son. The Bill Mumy character became the bitter son, and you know, the protagonist in the story, right? Mm-hmm. And or antagonist, I guess, antagonist, right?
Antagonist, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, so this is, I like this one because it's sort of a different take on the same sort of twist plan, you know, the abandoned ships. And in this case, they're not the only families out there, so that's kind of a different take on it too. So it's a bit like Battlestar Galactica in a sense, in that way, but
yeah, and it has a bit of that vibe, and just the whole it ties to a whole bunch of sci-fi tropes with the whole idea that, you know, Earth is becoming uninhabitable after years of damage, and they have to go and colonize other places, and it's a risky mission. And yeah, it's a really complex and a well-told story. It's been quite an enjoyable ride, and good characters. Again, even for a show that's had, you know, three or four of the main cast be young actors, they've all been really quite engaging and interesting and nuanced, and yeah, it's a good ride. I highly recommend. So December 1st, Netflix, go get it.
Cool.
And last but not least, I don't know if you gentlemen saw the trailer for this. There's a movie that is on HBO Max called 8-Bit Christmas. Have you guys seen this trailer?
Heard of it, but not nope. Seen it.
Yeah, so I put the link to the YouTube trailer on in our show notes. It stars Neil Patrick Harris as a person recapping an adventure from his boyhood in the 1980s, wherein all he wants for Christmas is a Nintendo Entertainment System, and his parents refuse to get one. So it's about this group of kids and the lengths that they're willing to go to get their hands on a Nintendo for Christmas. And if you watch the trailer, it looks like the second coming of A Christmas Story. It's about this group of kids and the sort of weird stuff that happens in their neighborhood and just these like strange adventures that they have in their daily lives. And that, you know, and instead of wanting the, you know, the Red Ryder BB gun, he wants the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it really, as soon as I saw the trailer, I just saw it yesterday. As soon as I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, this is like a modern Christmas story. And it's narrated by Neil Patrick Harris, sort of telling it to his daughter as the framing device, not unlike the sort of the narration that happens in A Christmas Story. So it looks funny, and it looks really, really cute. And I think identifiable for those of us who happen to have been children in the 1980s. And yeah, so I just caught this trailer yesterday. One of my friends on social posted it, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm totally gonna make the time for this looks like a fun Christmas watch. So
where is it gonna be?
HBO Max, and I believe it's in Crave here in Canada.
Cool. All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So hey Jonathan, people can get in touch with you, where do they find you?
You can always find me on Twitter and Instagram as @JPKNews.
And Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as @DevWithTheHair.
All right. My name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machines where you'll find me. And so until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
Also, Citra's birthday. My dog turned 2.
Yay!
Yeah, I saw that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
How old is Pollo?
Let me do the math. He is 8. So we think he was born. We think he was born in 2013, because he was around 2, according to the vet when we got him.
Oh, was he a rescue or?
Yeah. So he was surrendered to a rescue, along with a whole bunch of other Chihuahua puppies of some around his age, some, you know, less than a year old, probably. So it's hard to tell exactly. I mean, he's like the kids that show up in Little League every once in a while, like, for mysterious circumstances. And we're like, they seem a little big for 12. And like, oh, sure enough.
Well, that kid's 12. Got a lot of facial hair for 12.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Cool. How was your Yanksgiving, Jaime?
Good. We just spent it here, just the two of us. Social distancing and etc.
From each other? That's a little harsh.
6 feet apart and the
you stay on your side of the table.
The Batman 1989 style dinner table.
I was going to say that. That's perfect. Good, great pull.
And you know,
can you pass the salt? Sorry, yeah. What?
So we just had the all the fixins that you normally have for. I don't know if they differ for Canadian. For Canucksgiving or Yanksgiving, you know, you've got turkey and mashed potatoes and stuffing and cranberry sauce and pumpkin pie and stuff. So we had all of that.
Yeah, those are all staples in this family. Although, given our multicultural family, we also mix in Mulligatawny and Sri Lankan stuff. And yeah, it's become quite an eclectic meal for us, which is, I think, part of the best part of being Canadian. Just sort of, you know, everything comes to the table and we're like, awesome.
Yeah, but we don't get ambrosia salad though.
No ambrosia salad. No, what's the one that Americans do with the marshmallows on top?
Ambrosia.
Is that the ambrosia one?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't understand. Why? Why marshmallows on top?
It's basically dessert.
Is it?
Yeah, it's like somebody was describing the other day. It's like Jello and marshmallows, and I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking about, Jaime?
I had to look it up once you described the marshmallow. Yes. So this is not traditional in my family. I want to say this is a Southern thing, but granted, not a Texas thing, which is more Southwest.
Maybe.
Yeah, there you go. Ambrosia is an American variety of fruit salad originating in the Southern United States. It's something I tend to see at you know, like buffets or. Other kind of, you know, like a Luby's would probably have this sort of thing, you know, like a cafeteria that has a variety of things. It's not something I associate with Thanksgiving, but, you know, I'd mentioned pumpkin pie. There are alternatives like, I think sweet potato pie in other parts of the country and pecan or pecan pie, if you prefer, over pumpkin.
Oh, I love pecan pie.
You posted the pumpkin pie with the car, with the smoke coming out the tires.
Yes. It was not mine, but that was something I saw on the internet that had the little Hot Wheels car, like as if it was drifting, and then the Cool Whip or other things coming out the side, like the smoke, which is great.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So the whole pie wasn't covered with cream. It's just like this, like it was like as if the car had just, you know, on a donut, and the smoke was just rimming around the outside there. It looked pretty cool. The kind of thing that Xavier would have had for his pumpkin pie back when he was a kid.
Yeah. Or now.
Yeah, or now. Well, with ketchup, yes.
Oh, God. He's actually weaned himself off of ketchup a fair bit. It's really kind of surreal.
Yeah. Did either of you guys watch any of the Beatles stuff?
Not yet.
No, I haven't gotten a chance.
It's long.
Did they release all three parts, or are they going to tease it out week by week?
I think they're doing one a day. Like, so it started yesterday. I started watching it before I headed down to Genesis, and it was. I watched like an hour, and it was like long. I mean, I'm a huge Beatles fan. Don't get me wrong, but it was like long. And I only watched like I only managed to get like 45 minutes of it in there, and I'm like, this is long. And then I finished watching episode one tonight, right? And it's still long.
Oh yeah, it says it's two hours and 36 for the first part, 2 hours and 53 for the second part. Yeah, and it's a three-part documentary, so yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a lot.
Huh. I heard it's almost 9 hours, but yeah, it's amazing because, you know, like, as you know, I've told you before, I have the Let It Be.
Didn't they issue it to you if you lived in the suburbs?
No, I had to bootleg it off of Napster.
Oh.
I don't think it's ever been put out on any digital form. Well, it must have been on Laserdisc, I guess. Right? Because what I have is probably a bootleg from Laserdisc. It's not like, it's like SD quality. It's not, you know, high def.
Yeah.
And it tells quite a different story. It's obviously the same time period because that was the same movie that was being made at the same time, right? So.
Stephen Sondheim died.
Yeah, 91, 92?
91, it says, yeah.
Yeah, he just died today.
Mm-hmm. West Side Story.
Today, I should say.
West Side Story.
Yeah. And didn't he just redo it, or did they just redid it or something?
They just redid the theatrical version, yeah.
Right. Okay.
I think Spielberg.
He wrote those songs?
Yeah. La 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 in America. Kind of writes itself when you step back and look at it, doesn't it?
La 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 in America?
Yeah. Okay. That's a lyric from one of the songs.
Okay. That's the one that the Puerto Rican clan sings, right?
Yes.
I'm going to go with yes. Okay. Well, here's the tricky part, because I'm going to be away in the fourth week of December, just before Christmas, too. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll probably be able to record, but I'll be like really cold.
Oh, you're going up north, right?
Yeah, we're going to Northwest Territories.
Very cool.
Which isn't even a province, I mean. It's like so far north.
Yeah.
There's incorporated is the wrong word, unprovinced areas.
Yeah, we have a mix of provinces and territories here in Canada. So the provinces are sort of more populated and the territories are a little more sparse. So they run parallel to where Alaska would be. So Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Nunavut's a third now, right? Yeah. Because we used to have, what, 8 provinces and 2 territories, so 10 altogether. Now Nunavut's another one. Did they split Yukon and Northwest Territories to make Nunavut, or did they take it out of Northwest Territories?
It came out of Northwest Territories.
And is it on the Hudson's Bay side, Nunavut?
No. It's on, well, yeah, it is. I'm not sure what you were asking there. Yeah, it's, so Quebec is on the one side of Hudson's Bay and Nunavut is on the other side, yes.
Yeah.
And Nunavut encapsulates many of the islands that are the northern part of Canada, Baffin Island and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
Coolio.
We actually have a really good interview in our next Kaihai podcast with a doctor from Yukon talking about, she was the only pediatrician in the entire territory for a while, talking about her experiences of being the only pediatrician in an entire geographic region for thousands of kilometers. It's very interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
She was describing how she had, during 1 month, she had one day off. And during that one day off, she had to medevac a small child from Whitehorse to Vancouver to save her life. Very good story. Really worth tuning in for. That's The Chip. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Where you get your fine podcasts. Yep. Wherever fine podcasts are sold.
That's right.
Yep. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right, gents. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Right. Bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.